For the past year, the city of Denver has been debating how much surveillance power local police should have. Controversy arose after the discovery that Denver police had been keeping intelligence files on thousands of political activists. The so-called spy files date back to the 1950s, and most of the people in them have no connection to any crime. The American Civil Liberties Union filed suit, and the two sides have reached an agreement. Countering a national trend, the deal imposes new limits on police. NPR's Jennifer Ludden traveled to Denver and has this report.
The revelations have brought a steady stream of people to Denver's police headquarters. High school teacher Mark Sass already has a one-page spy file. It briefly tells how a few years ago he took part in a public skit about police accountability, a long-time hot issue here after charges of excessive force. But Sass is active with other groups, too, and he's convinced there are more files on him, so he keeps coming back to the officer behind the glass window.
Let's put in a request for an intelligence file.
Sass is told to wait. The growing list of those tracked by police has shocked and angered Denver's vibrant activist community. There are files on an elderly nun who advocates Indian rights, on church volunteers and college professors, on members of the American Friends Service Committee, a group that won the Nobel Peace Prize. Sass says over the years, protesters actually came to recognize the plainclothes men who'd snap their photos and jot down their license plate numbers.
People knew that there were officers who were there, and we believe, and I strongly believe, that this was keeping some people from coming out to demonstrations. And I think that that's that chilling effect that it has.
The ACLU cited this chilling effect in its lawsuit. It charged that decades of police monitoring had infringed the First Amendment rights of thousands of people and hundreds of groups named in police files. Since then, the city has been embroiled in public debate on the proper balance among civil liberties, privacy, and security. The issue has dominated meetings of Denver's civilian police oversight body, aired on cable TV.
Good evening. This is the Thursday, May 15th, 2003 meeting of the Public Safety Review Commission.
Like some process of truth and reconciliation, commissioners have subpoenaed police detectives, hoping to hash out what went wrong. On this night, they grill Police Chief Gerald Whitman about police infiltration of an activist meeting. Commissioner Karen Howard asks, didn't you at one point contact the Chicago and San Francisco police departments, and didn't they tell you they don't go to such meetings because of First Amendment concerns? Yes, Whitman says.
After that, did you do any investigation as to what the officers were doing in terms of infiltrating groups?
No.
Okay. Did you implement any guidelines for when they were supposed to or not supposed to implement, or I'm sorry, infiltrate groups?
Ten public meetings?
No, infiltrate groups.
Okay, no.
Okay.
Part of the problem was that police had no clear policy. Now they do, and the city touts its landmark agreement as a national model. ACLU lawyer Mark Silverstein says the deal reflects federal law. There must be a reasonable suspicion that a person or group is involved in criminal activity before police can open a file on them.
But Denver's policy now goes even farther because it attempts to limit the intelligence gathering to serious criminal activity. And it makes a special note of the fact that many times organizations and individuals may break the law in minor ways in the course of expressing their First Amendment rights.
So, for example, police can't open a file on someone who merely gets arrested at a sit-in. This makes Denver's policy more restrictive than many other cities. But that's the kind of place Denver is, says City Attorney J. Wallace Wortham. After all, he notes, Mayor Wellington Webb's first reaction to the scandal was, "Hey, I was a 60s activist. Do I have a file?" Attorney Wallace blamed the whole problem more on police sloppiness than ill intent. He points out many files have useless information and were long forgotten anyway. But Denver chose to take the issue seriously.
And I think it's to Denver's credit that as soon as we recognized that there was a situation where we could do better, we did better.
Fine, says former intelligence officer David Neal, but he sees trouble. The point of gathering intelligence, he says, is not to suppress free expression, but protect it. Yet the new policy forbids officers from tracking a lot of activity.
As long as it's done with how was that cleverly wordsmithed activity that takes the form of nonviolent civil disobedience? You tell me. Which misdemeanor law do we ignore?
If police can't monitor hate groups or disruptive protesters to learn who's planning what, Neil says, we won't be prepared if, say, an anti-globalization protest turns violent or animal rights activists start throwing red paint.
We will only be the agency that the citizens of Denver want us to be. If they don't want us collecting information and being prepared for these incidences, that's fine. If they do, they'll tell us. They'll tell us at the next demonstration that gets disrupted.
The spy file scandal came to light a year ago as police transferred their notes to a sophisticated new computer system that also raised the stakes. Suddenly, a file could find its way to some federal agency and cause trouble for an innocent victim. In fact, as more documents have been released, the ACLU has expressed alarm that Denver police did share intelligence with 24 Colorado agencies and the FBI. Now that Denver's new surveillance policy is more restrictive than federal rules, the ACLU's Mark Silverstein says there's a dilemma.
Denver supplies 2 full-time intelligence officers who work for the FBI's Joint Terrorism Task Force. When they are wearing their FBI hat as opposed to their Denver Police Department hat, it's not as clear that they are bound by this intelligence policy.
Police Chief Whitman has said they are, but an FBI spokesman says federal law would apply. The whole debate in Denver is reminiscent of another era. Back in the 70s and 80s, the excesses of Watergate, McCarthyism, and J. Edgar Hoover's FBI prompted a series of lawsuits against big city police departments. Activists won wide-ranging restrictions. But in recent years, the pendulum has been swinging back. Some restrictions expired, the courts eroded others, and the 9/11 terror attacks have increased pressure to relax surveillance rules. History teacher and activist Mark Sass explores such political shifts in his ninth grade classroom.
Another tactic used by the civil rights movement was the sit-in. This is a lunch counter at a Woolworths in the South.
Sass explains the black and white photos and his students scribble notes. Yet he worries they see no connection between past and present. When several read a newspaper article about him and the spy files, Sass says they assumed I did something wrong, and some thought that was kind of cool. Sass says more is needed to show the police were wrong.
You know, the settlement agreement helps to set some standards, but it doesn't really take care of any internal mechanism to ensure that if it does go wrong, that there's some punishment or that some discipline doesn't happen. And so, yes, somebody needs to be held accountable for this.
Whatever the new policy's faults, several cities have called Denver police to learn more about it. Meantime, an outstanding issue in Denver is what to do with the old intelligence files. The agreement leaves that decision up to the incoming mayor, and he'll face competing claims. The city attorney, worried about liability, wants the files destroyed. But Sass and many activists in the files want them preserved, a lasting symbol of police excess. To that end, one Colorado museum has offered to put the spy files on display. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News.